Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from a double issue, September 6th, September 13th, 2019. The cover drawing this week shows Brazilian President Bolsonaro. He's standing in the foreground in a politician suit and has his arms crossed and has just kind of a matter-of-fact look on his face. In the background, you can see a charred forest and off in the distance, flames jumping higher. The title of the cover this week is Torching the Amazon: Why Brazil's Bolsonaro Encourages the Burning of the Vital Rainforest. And that, in fact, is one of our first main stories. We'll start right there. At G7, Trump clashes with world leaders. What happened? President Trump looked isolated on the world stage this week as he clashed with allied leaders at the Group of Seven summit in France, skipping a meeting on climate change, attacking former President Obama, defending his trade war with China, and starting a heated exchange with other leaders over his contention that Russia should be readmitted to the group. Trump spoke publicly of great unity, but the annual three-day forum displayed little of the cooperative approach to global problem-solving it had in years past. French President Emmanuel Macron made a last-minute decision to host a parallel event with Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, who was sanctioned by the U.S. only last month, although Trump said Macron sought his approval ahead of time. Trump also broke with Japan over whether North Korean missile tests represented a violation of U.N. Security Council accords. On climate change, Trump waved away proposals for action, vowing not to trade away America's tremendous wealth in natural resources, dreams, and windmills, which, frankly, aren't working too well. Following the Trumpless climate meeting, Macron said the G7 would create a $22 million emergency fund to help Brazil combat more than 26,000 fires raging in the Amazon rainforest, calling it the lungs of the planet. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro rejected the offer angrily, saying it slighted Brazilian sovereignty, then followed up by insulting the appearance and age of Macron's wife, Bridget. In the end, Bolsonaro said Brazil might accept the aid after all, with the caveat that Brazil would determine how it was used. What the editorial said: you could just as well have called this the Group of Seven minus Trump, said the New York Times. Fellow leaders tiptoed around the American president to avoid provoking his unpredictable wrath. Now the world's major liberal democracy basically accept that they are out of sync with the president of the nation that should be leading their efforts. When Trump didn't show up to discuss the global threat of the Amazon fires, Macron and the others actually seemed relieved to carry on without the specter of Trump's presence. News reports are clearly painting the G7 as just another round of world appalled by Trump, said the New York Post. But the truth is, the president was the responsible one at this summit. He saw Macron's stunt with Iran's foreign minister for what it was: a pander to Macron's domestic critics. Bottom line, Trump refused to go ballistic over the empty gesture and took it in stride. That's how a real statesman acts. What the columnist said: Trump may have seemed absent from much of the G7 summit, but thanks to Trump's advocacy, Russia's Vladimir Putin was almost present, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Watching Trump blame Putin's Crimean annexation on President Obama was an Orwellian spectacle. Behind closed doors, Trump was even more pro-Putin, arguing the case to bring him back into the group so vehemently that it was tantamount to having Putin himself in the room. Trump may have come up with a new way to arrange the guest list, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg.com. He's been floating the possibility of hosting the Group of Seven summit at his Terral Golf Club next year. Each country, Trump suggested, can have their own villa or their own bungalow. The search for personal profit is the bedrock principle of Trump's conduct. The message that he's sending to his own administration and foreign leaders is that only a chump would miss a chance to do the same. It's hardly a surprise that Bolsonaro, the Trump of the tropics, claimed the G7 was infringing on Brazil's sovereignty by pledging money to fight Amazon fires, said Frida Guedes in CNN.com. Both presidents share the same creed. Be wary of international cooperation and reject sacrifices for a common good. But the crisis in the Amazon shows the lie at the heart of this worldview. Countries can no longer wall themselves in and pretend that what goes on beyond their borders does not affect them. As the nationalist demagogues ignore it, the Amazon is burning at a rate of 1.5 soccer fields per minute. That's a threat to us all. Here's a short, it wasn't all bad piece right under that main story. At 70, Bob Long has just won the world's longest horse race, outpacing 43 younger competitors to become the oldest person to finish the Mongol Derby. Long navigated across Mongolia's mountains, rivers, and unfamiliar terrain in a punishing 621-mile race on semi-wild horses. While others sustained injuries or struggled to finish, Long pressed through, completing it in 7 days, riding 28 different horses. After watching a documentary about the Mongol Derby and becoming inspired to compete, the retired chief technology officer began training with previous winners of the race, riding 4 or 5 horses a day. Preparation, said Long, trumps youth. We'll read a second main story this week. U.S. and China trade punches. What happened? The trade war between the U.S. and China escalated to a new level of hostility as a frustrated President Trump threatened last week to cut off all U.S. business with China. In retaliation for an earlier round of U.S. tariffs, China imposed duties of 5 to 25% on $75 billion worth of U.S. goods, including crude oil, automobiles, soybeans, pork, and corn. The Trump administration responded by raising planned tariffs on $300 billion worth of goods, including electronics, clothing, and toys, from 10 to 15%, with Trump threatening to hike taxes as high as 30% on another list of products. An enraged Trump also tweeted a demand that alarmed corporate leaders and sent markets temporarily plunging. Our great American companies are hereby ordered to immediately start looking for an alternative to China, including bringing our companies home and making your products in the USA, he said on Twitter. We don't need China, and frankly, would be far better off without them. Trump also attacked Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell for not slashing interest rates to bolster the economy. My only question is, who is our bigger enemy, Jay Powell or Chairman Xi? Trump asked, referring to Chinese President Xi Jinping. Trump later tried to dial down the rhetoric, admitting to having second thoughts about the trade war and praising Xi as a great leader. Trump also claimed Chinese officials had called about resuming talks, eager to reach a trade deal. Beijing, however, denied making any such calls. Asked about his mixed messages, Trump was defiant. "Sorry, it's the way I negotiate," he told reporters at the G7 summit. "It's done very well for me over the years." What the editorial said. Trump has no clue how to deliver a trade deal, said USA Today. He keeps lurching between hard line and conciliatory stances. Markets panicked after Trump ordered American companies to pull out of China. An authoritarian threat that would have made Republicans' heads explode if it had come from, say, President Obama. But a few days later, the president was playing up the possibility of a deal. How are businesses supposed to make plans in this environment? Beijing might decide to simply wait Trump out instead of trying to negotiate with such an erratic partner. After all, Trump faces an election next year. Chinese leaders do not. Trump has good cause to want to confront China over its cheating and unfair trade practices, said the National Review. But he needs to fight smarter, not harder. Tariffs are a blunt instrument that hurt us as well as China and invite ready retaliation from the Chinese. The tariffs are costing the average American hundreds of dollars a year. Trump should find other ways to pressure Beijing, such as limiting Chinese students' access to our universities and foraging free trade deals with our allies. What the columnist said. Trump's attack on the Fed chair was stunning even for him, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. So was his bizarre order to private companies to stop doing business with China. Sensing that he's losing this trade war, Trump clearly longs to be like his rival, Xi Jinping, an authoritarian presiding over a command economy. Trump has already shown an appetite for central planning, spending $16 billion on subsidies to appease farmers hurt by his trade war. Ironically, Trump is sending taxpayers' dollars to farm country, even as he lambasts his Democratic opponents as a bunch of socialists. Despite the big bailout, farmers are not happy, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Billions in aid can't make up for effectively closing off the world's biggest export market. Farm bankruptcies are rising while sales of soybeans, pork, and wheat are plummeting. Trump keeps insisting that farmers are starting to do great again, but they're getting tired of his gaslighting and loudly booed Agricultural Secretary Sonny Perdue at a recent town hall in Minnesota. "We're not starting to do great again," Brian Thalman, the president of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, told Perdue. Admittedly, Trump's messaging is flawed, said Myron Magnet in the New York Post. But for years, China has forced American companies to turn over proprietary technology for the right to do business there, knowledge Beijing is using to achieve superpower status. Trump needs to better explain that sacrifices are necessary because America's safety and geostrategic power are at stake. But economically divorcing China is more than just a sacrifice, said Peter Goodman in the New York Times. For better or worse, the United States and China have been fused for two decades. Our symbiotic relationship accounts for 40% of the world's economic output. Any disruption will ripple far and wide. Trump can fight with China or grow the economy. He cannot do both. What's next? In theory, Trump could legally force American companies to divest from China, said David Fickling in Bloomberg.com. The president has wide-ranging powers under the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which allows him to block further investments in China by declaring it a security threat. But our investment in China is effectively too big to fail. U.S. businesses have nearly $200 billion invested in China, value that would be destroyed in a chaotic fire sale that would surely trigger a recession. American companies increasingly rely on China, said Jim Zaroli in NPR.org. Firms like Starbucks, Nike, and Boeing make a large part of their profits serving China's growing middle class, which is now bigger than the entire U.S. population. KFC sells more chicken in China than in the U.S., for example, and General Motors more automobiles. Apple not only makes most of its iPhones in China, but also is banking on it for sales growth. If the trade war becomes even more punitive, some companies could end up as casualties. Controversy of the week, the 1619 Project, a true picture of American history. Remember when the New York Times used to at least feign impartiality, said Joshua Lawson in TheFederalist.com? Those days are gone. The paper of record last week launched the 1619 Project, a sprawling, ongoing series of essays seeking, in the project's own words, to reframe the country's history by putting the evil of slavery at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are. Named for the year that African slaves first arrived in Virginia, the project claims that anti-black racism runs in the very DNA of this country, and that our founding ideals were false when they were written. That is leftist propaganda. Slavery was an abomination, but it also existed in British, French, Portuguese, and Dutch colonies into the 19th century, in China and Korea until the 20th, and in several Middle Eastern countries until roughly 50 years ago. So why portray the U.S. as uniquely evil? In fact, the founders purposely kept the term slavery out of the Constitution, setting in motion the forces that led to the Civil War and slavery's abolition, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Our nation was and is imperfect, but to pretend that racism constituted one of the country's founding principles is an odious and reductive lie. White supremacy wasn't a stated principle of our founding, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. But it's undeniable that the economic expansion of early America was fueled by the forced labor of black slaves, whom whites insisted were inferior creatures designed by God for servitude. The 1619 Project's great triumph is how it draws the genealogical lines between that openly racist system and its legacy in modern America, including the vast chasm between average white and black family wealth, the huddled masses in its prisons, and the abandonment of black inner cities. Indeed, the legacy of slavery can be found in every nook and cranny of the American experience, said Jeet here in TheNation.com. For a century after the Civil War, whites literally stole land from freed slaves, enacted Jim Crow laws that stripped blacks of nearly all rights, used lynchings and violence to terrorize them into submission, and even excluded blacks from New Deal and post-World War II programs designed to build middle-class wealth. Without the persistent, heroic efforts by African Americans to force America to live up to the promises of our Constitution, the Time series points out, our democracy might not be a democracy at all. The battle isn't won yet, said Ellis Coase in USA Today. Almost every week, angry white supremacists with guns who long to restore America's historic racial hierarchy are slaughtering their fellow citizens. It is deeply irresponsible to pretend that the past does not matter or that it no longer influences who we are. The 1619 series is right about a lot, said Timothy Sandifer in Reason.com. But it goes wrong in trying to prove that slavery was, as its authors put it, the source of nearly everything that has truly made America exceptional. Slavery was abolished only because millions of people, both white and black, did believe that all men are created equal and laid their lives on the line, not only in the 1860s, but ever since, to make good on the promissory note of the Declaration. That struggle and our painful progress toward our founding ideals is also central to our national story. Time for the Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for pleading impotence. After six senior citizens were charged with having sex in a Connecticut park. "I haven't had sex in maybe 10 years," said defendant Richard Butler, 85, in proclaiming his innocence. "I got no blood flow." It was a good week for self-defense after a Colorado couple got into what police called a boxing match with a bear and its cub that had invaded their home. The man, 71, pummeled the bear with his fists while his wife struck it with a baseball bat, sending the invaders fleeing. And it was a good week for thinking out of the box after Axios.com reported that President Trump has more than once suggested to aides that the U.S. drop nuclear bombs on approaching hurricanes to disrupt their rotation. Aides reportedly responded, "Sir, we'll look into that." It was a bad week for Alex Hoodson, a news anchor at KOCO5 TV in Oklahoma City, who told her stunned African-American co-anchor Jason Hackett that a baby gorilla in a video segment kind of looks like you. Hoodson later tearfully apologized. It was a bad week for lacking a paddle, with the rescue of an Oregon woman who fell into a backyard septic tank and was trapped neck deep in raw sewage for 3 days. "It was a scary situation," said paramedic Nick Wetlaufer. And it was a bad week for loudmouths, with the discovery by University of Cambridge scientists of an inverse correlation between the size of a howler monkey's testicles and the loudness of his howls. After monkeys develop a large set of vocal cords, researchers theorized, there is simply not enough energy left to invest in testes. And a short piece while we're here, FEC toothless with three empty seats. The Federal Election Commission is no longer has the necessary quorum to complete its basic responsibilities after Vice Chairman Matthew Peterson resigned this week. The FEC, tasked with overseeing how money is raised and spent in elections, will have just three of six seats occupied, preventing it from holding board meetings, opening audits, or levying fines for campaign finance violations. President Trump nominated James Traynor, a Republican lawyer, to serve on the board in 2017, but he hasn't been confirmed by the Senate, which traditionally confirms Democratic and Republican commissioners simultaneously to maintain parity. "Without an FEC quorum," said Ann Revel, FEC chairwoman until 2017, "campaign finance could end up being the Wild West." We'll read a few of the pieces from the segment called The U.S. at a Glance, starting in Boston. Students barred from U.S. Immigration officers searched an incoming Harvard University freshman's cell phone for political content last week at Logan International Airport before revoking his visa. Ismail Ajawi, a Palestinian student who lives in Tyre, Lebanon, says an immigration official screamed at him after finding he had friends posting political points of view that opposed the U.S. on his social media. A Customs and Border Protection spokesperson confirmed Ajawi was deemed inadmissible, but declined to elaborate. Ajawi said he was detained at the airport with a handful of international students, but was forced to stay 8 hours longer after they were released. He says he was asked about his religious practices and social media activity while officials demanded access to his cell phone and laptop. Before being deported, Ajawi says he told his interrogator, "I shouldn't be held responsible for what others post." Washington, D.C. Holiday splurge. Attorney General William Barr booked the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. for a lavish holiday party that will cost him at least $31,500, the Washington Post reported this week. Barr hosts an annual soiree for family and friends, and his choice of venue for this year's December 8th event drew criticism from those who say President Trump improperly profits from his businesses, especially the D.C. hotel. Barr plans to invite about 200 people to enjoy a buffet and four-hour open bar. The tab could run north of $45,000, the Post reports. Barr says he consulted Justice Department ethics officials before booking the hotel last month, and did so only after learning that two other hotels are unavailable. D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine said Barr's party normalizes conduct of presidential supporters who patronize Trump's businesses to curry favor with the president. Kansas City, Missouri. Abortion ban blocked. A federal judge blocked Missouri's ban on abortions after the 8th week of pregnancy this week, one day before it was set to take effect, saying the law is likely unconstitutional. Judge Howard Sachs criticized lawmakers' hostility to Supreme Court precedent, calling the bill passed in May a protest against decisions such as Roe v. Wade. He said it would block about half of reported abortions in Missouri, where just one abortion clinic remains. Sachs did allow other components of the law to take effect, including bans on abortions motivated solely by the sex or race of the fetus or by a diagnosis of Down syndrome. The law would punish medical professionals who break the 8-week rule with up to 15 years in prison. Roe established a 24-week standard. Missouri created exceptions for when a woman faces a medical emergency, but not for when a pregnancy results from rape or incest. Tahlequah, Oklahoma, a seat in Congress. The Cherokee Nation announced plans last week to send a delegate to Congress for the first time in the tribe's history. Newly sworn in Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. cited the 1835 Treaty of New Ecota, though this treaty provided the dubious legal basis for the Trail of Tears. It also entitled the Cherokee to send a delegate to the House of Representatives. "These treaties are sacred. There's no expiration date," said Hoskin, whose tribe, the largest in the U.S., has nearly 400,000 members. "What I'm asking is for the government of the United States to keep its word." Hoskin chose Kimberly Teehee, a Democrat and former Obama administration advisor, to serve in the role. It's unclear whether the House will seat Teehee. If it does, she will have the same authority as the House's six other non-voting representatives. They can't vote on the House floor, but can vote in committees, introduce legislation, and participate in debate. Now the world at a glance. London. UK to suspend Parliament. Prime Minister Boris Johnson took the extraordinary step this week of suspending Parliament, just weeks before the UK is to leave the European Union. Johnson says he needs the five-week break, which will start about September 11th, so he can bring forward an ambitious new legislative program to be unveiled with a great pomp in a Queen's speech on October 14th. But lawmakers say his decision is designed to block them from finding a way to avert a no-deal Brexit. The Brexit deadline is October 31st, and Johnson has vowed to take the UK out of the Union on that day, even if no deal has been reached with the EU to govern such issues as customs duties, food inspections, and the status of EU citizens in the UK. A no-deal Brexit is widely seen as inviting economic chaos and recession, and lawmakers had planned to cancel their upcoming three-week recess in order to pass a law forbidding it. Parliament Speaker John Bercow accused Johnson of an offense against the democratic process, while others called his actions dangerous and irresponsible, and even what dictators do. With the maneuver, Johnson risks a no-confidence vote that would bring down the government. If that happens, a caretaker government would try to negotiate an extension of the Brexit deadline with the EU and then call a general election. The European Parliament's Brexit coordinator condemned the move as sinister and said it raised the chance of a tumultuous no-deal Brexit. Mexico City, decriminalizing cocaine. A court in Mexico has ordered the country's health authority to allow two unidentified people to possess and use cocaine, but not sell it. Under Mexican law, the ruling does not create a precedent or strike down current laws that make possession of cocaine illegal in Mexico, and it could be overruled. But if it is upheld, and if four similar cases can be brought and upheld, then decriminalization would be the law of the land. That legal strategy is how activists decriminalized marijuana in Mexico in 2018, and pot is expected to be officially legalized later this year. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has pledged to reform the prohibitionist approach toward drugs that generates violence and poor public health outcomes. Santiago, Chile. Chile has declared a state of emergency because of drought stretching across the country, including the capital, Santiago. Skeletal cattle are collapsing and dying on ranches, while boats have been left abandoned in dried-up marinas. The region has been suffering from drought since 2010, and scientists say it will only get worse. We are talking about a process of desertification rather than a temporary drought or absence of rain problem, Felipe Mercado, director of the country's Resilience Institute, told the Santiago Times. The government is developing a plan to provide water to copper mines in order to support Chile's main export industry. Tehran, scientists accused. Eight Iranian scientists studying the endangered Asiatic cheetah across seven Iranian provinces have been charged with espionage. The scientists, there were nine, but one died in custody, had secured all necessary permits to set up camera traps to find the elusive cheetahs, believed to number fewer than 50. But because their group, the Persian Wildlife Heritage Foundation, received funding from abroad, they drew the attention of Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guard Corps and were arrested last year. Four faced the death penalty, while the others could get 10 years in prison. The researcher who died, Kavos Sayed Emani, was the foundation's chairman. Iran said he committed suicide, but his family believes he was tortured to death. Tel Aviv, striking at Iran. Israel attacked three countries in 2 days this week, targeting Iranian proxies across the region. Israeli forces struck a military site in Syria to prevent what officials said was a planned attack by Iranian forces. An Israeli drone attack in Iraq killed two members of an Iranian-aligned militia. In Lebanon, an Israeli drone hit a base used by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and another drone hit close to Hezbollah office on the outskirts of Beirut. The strike comes as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu prepares for an election in mid-September, campaigning on his ability to keep Israelis safe. Multiple times in the past year, Iranian forces have attempted to launch rockets and missiles at Israel from Syria. We're on the briefing page now. Refers back to that cover drawing. It's called The Destruction of the Amazon. The lungs of the earth are on fire and shrinking every day. What are the consequences for the planet? What's happening? Tens of thousands of fires are burning across the vast Amazon basin, consuming 4.6 million acres of irreplaceable rainforest since the beginning of the year. Thick black smoke visible from space wafts over the land, plunging Brazil's largest city, Sao Paulo, into daytime darkness and filling hospitals with patients in respiratory distress. More than 36,000 of the 77,000 fires in the Amazon this year began in the last month alone. The Brazilian Space Agency, which monitors the blazes by satellite, says most of the damage is in the northwestern Brazilian state of Roraima, Acre, Rondônia, and Amazonas, where more than double the usual amount of acreage is on fire. This is not natural. More than 90% of these fires have been set by loggers and ranchers seeking to clear land. With the encouragement of the Brazilian government, deforestation of the Amazon has surged to the highest level in a decade and is now galloping along at 3 football fields every minute. Half of the clear cutting and burning has occurred in protected lands. Why is the Amazon so important? Home to 3 million species of plants and animals, the vast rainforest is the most biodiverse region on the planet. Some 400 billion trees absorb millions of tons of carbon dioxide every year, crucial to slowing climate change, and emit about 6% of Earth's oxygen. These trees also respire moisture, pulling fresh water from the ground and cycling it into the air, creating one of the atmospheric rivers of moisture that regulate rainfall across the planet. Rainfall in the American Midwest, for example, heavily depends upon water coming from the Amazon. Over the past half century, though, 1/5 of the rainforest, 300,000 square miles, an area larger than Texas, has been deforested. Scientists say if another 10% is lost, the ecosystem will reach a tipping point at which it will dry up irreversibly, converting the entire remaining rainforest into a savanna. The consequences for the planet could be devastating. Why has it gotten so bad? Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, a far-right, pro-business former army captain, took office in January with a pledge to open the rainforest to development. Not 1 centimeter more, he vowed, would be set aside for the 1 million indigenous Brazilians who have lived in the rainforest for millennia. Bolsonaro packed his cabinet with climate change deniers and agribusiness executives and transferred responsibility for indigenous territories from the Justice Ministry, which protected the rights of Amazon forest tribes, to the Agriculture Ministry, which promotes farming and ranching. One Brazilian lawmaker described the shift as letting the fox take over the chicken coop. Bolsonaro also slashed staff and funding for IBAMA, the agency responsible for enforcing environmental laws, firing 21 of its 27 state heads. Since he took office, the number of fires in the rainforest has risen by 84%. Why is he doing this? With Brazil's economy struggling, Bolsonaro sees the Amazon as the country's greatest exploitable resource, and he believes that environmentalists are a front for foreign colonialists who want to control Brazil. Last week, he claimed that the fires were set by non-governmental organizations trying to make his government look bad. Bolsonaro wants to boost the beef and soy industries. Soy is the country's biggest export at $26 billion a year, and reclaiming land from the Amazon is the quickest way. Cleared of its lush vegetation, though, Amazon soil is nutrient poor and quickly depleted, so cattlemen and farmers have to move on, claiming even more forest land after just a few growing seasons. What is the international community doing? French President Emmanuel Macron, who has called the Amazon fires an international crisis, put the issue at the top of this week's G7 summit. Macron also said he would seek to pull the EU out of Mercosur, a massive trade deal 20 years in the making that is being finalized with Brazil and other Latin American countries. The deal was contingent on Brazil doing more to protect the rainforest, but now, said a spokesperson for Macron, the president can only conclude President Bolsonaro lied to him. A nationalist, Bolsonaro has favored economic protectionism and has also rejected international aid to fight the Amazon's fires, saying countries send it with the aim of interfering with our sovereignty. With criticism mounting, he has sent in the army to help extinguish the blazes. What else can be done? If the fires burn out or can be put out, there is plenty that Brazilians can do to mitigate the damage. Indigenous leaders have proposed ways to open their lands to economic development without cutting down trees. They want to exploit the Amazon's biodiversity for medical research and ecotourism, and they hope to partner with agribusiness to expand sustainable food crops like acai, Brazil nuts, and fruit. None of this will happen, though, as long as Bolsonaro is in office, and his first term doesn't end until 2023. By then, if the current rate of deforestation doesn't slow, the forest will be close to its tipping point. Loss of ancestral homelands. 1 million indigenous people call the Amazon forest home, but Bolsonaro thinks their communities are a waste of valuable land. On his second day in office, he tweeted that Indians aren't part of the real Brazil, saying, "We're going to integrate these citizens and give them values as real Brazilians. That means forcing tribes off their ancestral lands where they have been stewards of the forest and into cities. It's the same assimilation policy that was pursued by the 1964 to 1985 military dictatorship that Bolsonaro openly admires, a junta that killed more than 8,300 indigenous people while pursuing Amazon development. Already, he has reversed a decades-long ban on mining his indigenous territory and halted the enforcement of logging bans. With Bolsonaro, the invasions are worse and will continue to get worse," Francisco Umanari, an Apurina chief, told TheIntercept.com. "It's become a question of life and death." Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. Yair Rosenberg of the Washington Post writes, "Reinforcing stereotypes about Jews. Is Donald Trump a philo-Semite or an anti-Semite?" asked Yair Rosenberg. That question came to the fore last week when the president said American Jews who vote for Democrats and against him are disloyal to Israel, an inversion of the traditional dual loyalty trope, which accuses Jews of being more loyal to Israel than to their home countries. Trump is actually telling Jews that their primary loyalty should be to Israel. As a president, he has told American Jews at gatherings that Israel is your country and Benjamin Netanyahu is your prime minister. Throughout his life, Trump has demonstrated that he believes all the anti-Semitic stereotypes about Jews. He has said he wants people with yarmulks counting his money and openly depicts Jews as aggressive lawyers and shrewd businessmen who know how to buy political influence. Yet Trump sees these stereotypes as admirable because he has always stood solely for his own naked self-interest and thinks everyone should operate that way. This kind of philo-Semitism by a U.S. president, however, is deeply dangerous. It reinforces the beliefs of bigots that Jews are rich, powerful, and more loyal to Israel than to the U.S. That kind of love the Jews can do without. At some point, these stereotypes will be weaponized against us. Why football players are quitting. When Indianapolis Colts quarterback Andrew Luck walked off the field for the final time as a player this week, it was to the sound of boos from fans, said Jamel Hill. At the age of 29, Luck had decided to retire and give up millions in future earnings because his body had been ravaged by injuries during six seasons in the NFL, including a lacerated kidney or torn labrum in his throwing shoulder and at least one concussion. Some fans knock Luck for quitting because they still see football stars as warriors and gladiators who should willingly sacrifice everything to play an incredibly violent game. But the mentality of the players has changed. Luck is one of the growing number to walk away at a relatively young age, including New England Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski, who quit this year at age 30. This generation of players has seen that concussions and other injuries have left previous ones with dementia or crippling pain or both. They're also keenly aware that the NFL and its fans see them as physical objects to be used up. And that's a price some are no longer willing to pay. This from France. Macron now sets world's agenda. Emmanuel Macron is the only world leader ready to face our existential challenges, said Edward Luce in the Financial Times. The French president played host to the group of seven major democracies this year, rolling out the red carpet at the glitzy Basque seaside resort of Biarritz. But Macron's role was more than symbolic. The leader of the world's democracies has traditionally been the U.S. But in Donald Trump, the U.S. has a president with an allergy to all things to do with alliances, democracies, cooperation, and so forth. Germany's Angela Merkel is now fading gracefully into retirement. Canada's Justin Trudeau is facing an election. Boris Johnson just wants to complain about Ireland. And Italy really has no leader at all. Alone among world leaders, Macron is trying to spark a serious conversation on life and death issues that affect us all. Macron is ready to take his big turn on the world stage, if only he can manage Trump, said François-Xavier Bourmont. He wants to work out the world's problems from Syria to the Amazon, except the U.S. president keeps worsening them or creating more. Trump withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, to which European countries are also a party. Trump started a trade war with China that is reverberating in other countries, and he rejects climate science. Macron knows Trump pretty well by now, and he recognizes that the only way to get him to change course is to offer him a better deal. So on Iran, Macron tried to do just that by inviting Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif to Biarritz and repeatedly raising the subject of a new, better Iran deal. He actually got Trump to agree to eventual talks with Iran, mediated by France. With his perfect English and relentless glad-handing, Macron shows himself to be the master of diplomacy, said Barbara Wessel in Deutsche Welle. To tackle the Amazon rainforest, he used both carrots and sticks. First, he threatened Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro with the abrogation of the Mercosur trade deal between the EU and Brazil if Bolsonaro did not do more to fight the fires. And presto, the Brazilian army turned out to do just that. Then Macron coaxed the G7 members into creating a $22 million rainforest emergency fund. But that achievement is in doubt after Brazil demanded an apology for being left out of the talks, said Stefan Brandi in Der Standard. Meanwhile, Macron's proposed tax on digital giants like Google and Amazon went nowhere, and there was no progress on combating terrorism in West Africa, one of his pet projects. Still, this G7 saw no Trump-induced diplomatic catastrophe, and in today's world, that counts as a win. No one could expect anything more. And we will finish out on the talking points page. Joe Walsh, a Tea Partier, takes on Trump. Joe Walsh is here to tell his fellow Republicans that the emperor has no clothes, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. The conservative talk radio host and former Illinois congressman is launching a chaotic primary challenge against President Trump, highlighting our unhinged commander-in-chief's obvious unfitness for office. Walsh calls Trump a racial arsonist who encourages bigotry and xenophobia and blasts him for siding with Vladimir Putin over our own intelligence community. Unlike Trump's other challenger, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, a moderate, Walsh is a Tea Party stalwart who hated President Obama and fluently speaks the language of the right. He supported Trump in 2016, but now regrets his decision, horrified not only by the president's behavior, but also by his physical irresponsibility and authoritarian ways. Walsh is exactly the right guy to take on Trump. Walsh is missing one big thing, a constituency, said David Marcus in TheFederalist.com. Almost 90% of Republicans approve of the job Trump is doing. They don't want to return to the days of so-called principled conservatives such as Mitt Romney and John McCain, who pulled their punches and lost elections in the culture war to the Democrats. At least Trump fights. Walsh is now just another irrelevant, never-Trumper. No progressive should cheer Walsh's run, said Arwa Mahadawi in The Guardian. For most of his career, he was basically a carbon copy of the president, trafficking in racism and Islamophobia and spreading the birther conspiracy theory that Obama was a secret Muslim born in Kenya. Walsh insists that he's a changed man. What is more likely is that he reckons there is a payday in all this. Walsh has virtually no chance of ousting Trump, said Will Weissert and the Associated Press. But if he gains any traction at all, it could damage the president. The only modern incumbent presidents to face serious primary challenges were Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and George H.W. Bush. All three were weakened enough to ultimately lose re-election. Challenging Trump may be a political suicide mission, said Matt Lewis in TheDailyBeast.com. But Republicans deserve the chance to say Trump doesn't speak for all of us. While other Trump critics within the GOP have fearfully sat on the sidelines, Walsh has actually stepped up. Joe Walsh has guts. Let's give him that. And we'll read some of the shorter notes here, starting with the U.S. has almost completely stopped issuing visas to Iraqis who worked for American forces as translators. Only two Iraqi translators received U.S. visas last year, compared with 325 in 2016. Hundreds of interpreters have been killed by militants since 2003. Conservative operatives allied with the White House say they have compiled fireable information on several hundred journalists and their families that they will use to discredit news organizations they deem hostile to the president. The group has already released anti-Semitic social media posts by Tom Wright Pierisante, a 32-year-old New York Times political editor, made while he was in college. Fox News host Tucker Carlson has lost at least five advertisers in the past 2 weeks after calling the threat of white supremacy a hoax in the aftermath of the El Paso mass shooting. Carlson, who has also said immigration makes the U.S. poorer and dirtier, has gone from a high of 36 paid ads per episode in October 2018 to 15 in August 2019. The minimum wage for restaurant servers and other tipped employees is less than $5 an hour in 36 states. About 4.4 million U.S. workers rely on tips to make a living, two-thirds of them women, and many have to frequently work double and triple shifts to make ends meet. We'll finish with a quote from Stephen King, who says, "Any good marriage is secret territory, a necessary white space on society's map. What others don't know about it is what makes it yours." And that's it for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next week. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us, 919-832-5138.